and knew all of that. But there was something she didn't know. In a thick voice, she asked, "Are Parsethians allowed to speak lies if it is in jest?" The amusement on Ardal's face vanished into a frown of displeasure.
"There is no joke in a lie. It dishonors the speaker and insults the listener."
"Oh." Hope and happiness filled Yvonne's breast, yet the confusion remained. She was not a warrior queen yet. Did Madoc truly mean to make her one then? How? Even Yvonne's mother and younger brother, the two people who believed in her most and loved her best, had never suggested the possibility. In their tower, Queen Visenne had made her run and exercise her muscles, had shown her how to conceal a knife within her robes, but never had Yvonne's lessons extended beyond that. Given the weakness of Yvonne's body, her mother had often said that her mind was her best weapon, so they had focused on sharpening her brain and her tongue instead of sharpening blades. Ranashev had put a bow into her hands and taught her to use it, true. If she'd ever intended to teach Yvonne more, however, she'd never spoken of it. They'd only spoken of the single arrow that would fly from Yvonne's bow and facilitate Ranashev's escape. Yet Yvonne had dreamed of more arrows, and of being free, and using that bow to defend herself and her people. She needed no great strength for that, only strength enough to draw a bowstring. Then her father had cut off her fingers and severed any hope she had of using that weapon again. Madoc knew of her weakness. He knew of her missing fingers. He knew of her shattered knee. Yet still he claimed that a warrior queen could be made of her? Even knowing he always spoke truth, she hardly dared believe it. Perhaps Bannock sensed her turmoil, for he was studying her face with concern, deepening the lines beside his eyes.
"Why do you ask, my lady?"
This newer doubt and pain had too sharp an edge, so she chose the pain that had already dulled. "That first eve I told you all that I had never ridden a horse. None of you believed me. Yet you did not respond as if you were insulted by a lie. Instead, you laughed as if I had been making fun." Except for Madoc, whose laughter had been cruel and mocking, because he had immediately understood that she spoke the truth. "Ah!" Now Ardal's face cleared. "If it is something that everyone knows cannot be true, that can be a joke. There is no deception if a truth is well known." And to a Parsathian, the idea that someone might have never sat upon a horse was unbelievable. It could only be a joke. So, too, would be making a warrior queen of Yvonne. The crushing disappointment within her chest threatened to fold her over, but she hid that pain in the task of untying her wineskin from the saddle. Behind her, Bannock confirmed.
"Such it is. If someone were to say your father was a fine king, everyone would know it for a joke."
Yvonne forced herself to answer. "And if the speaker meant it?"
"Then we would know him for a fool," Ardal replied. "Either way, it is good for a laugh."
Was that why Madoc had said it then? Had he been trying to humor her? On the heels of his apology, perhaps he had been trying to make amends. For certain, on this day she had not sensed any cruelty in him, and he could not know how making of a joke of it could hurt her so badly. She had joked of it herself at the ruins. Perhaps he'd wished to return to the ease they'd found then before the blood wraiths had come. But when he'd given her a warrior's lesson this morn, she had thought he might be telling the truth. She'd wanted to believe he was. Yet making a warrior queen of her was something no one could believe. Instead, her hope only marked her as a fool. Well, it would not be the first time, or likely the last. Ardal remained at her side as Bannock led the horses to the stream. Standing upon the opposite bank was Madoc, sun gleaming over his dark skin. With a short blade, he scythed through handfuls of tall grass before tossing the fresh stalks to Torek, who cut away the tough, fibrous stem from the tender leaves near the top, which the horses could more easily eat. So quickly they worked that in the time it had taken Yvonne to saddle her roan, they had already harvested enough feed for each horse. Madoc tucked away his blade. In a single mighty leap that filled Yvonne with both awe and envy, he cleared the stream. Lightly, as if his feet bore feathers instead of his massive weight, he landed upon the near bank in a crouch, the outer length of his red linens flaring wide before settling around his powerful legs. Left behind to bundle the grasses, Torek waved one of the woody stems in his direction like a mock sword. As Madoc rose, the other warrior called out his name. Then Torek abruptly stopped, tilting the stem straight upward, his eyebrows shooting high. Madoc's hearty laugh rolled across the clearing, a response to something Torek said and Yvonne had not heard, but which prompted both warriors to glance in her direction. Madoc's gaze caught hers, and she could not read his expression at all, but for the longest breath, that look held her captive. No longer was he laughing when he glanced away. Yet Yvonne could not stop looking upon him, and she slowly realized that another statement she had taken as truth had likely been a joke. To Ardal she asked, "Is his beard truly a foul sight?"
For surely no one could believe it so. Clean-shaven or no, Madoc must be thought very handsome, no matter who looked upon him. The woman's peal of laughter was answer enough, but Yvain wanted more.
"Yet is it also true that warriors should be a silver-fingered Rani who wears no beard?"
"It is truth, but we must sometimes hope to be more than goddesses are." Drawing her sword, Ardal added, "You have to piss?"
Yvain nodded.
"Come then, and mind your feet. The edges of these stalks can slice skin as easily as sharpened steel can,"
Ardal said, and led Yvain into the rustling grass. Almost immediately they were swallowed from sight of the clearing. The warrior stopped and stomped flat a small circle for Yvain to squat in. Turning her back to allow Yvain privacy, she continued,
"Ran Eshev wore her hair unbound when she stood before the tribes."
Madoc's mother. Her dark hair had been braided again when Yvain had met her. But she dared not ask more. She had promised Madoc not to speak of his mother at all.
"And his father?"
"Cut his braids short. He wore no beard," Ardal said,
and her voice softened in grief or memory.
"Though he did when his own mother died. He was not only a warrior then, not only Ran, but a son."
Absently, she brushed her fingertips over the piercings on her brow. "Just as I am a daughter."
The last daughter of a clan that had been slaughtered by the Destroyer.
Yvain had heard that tale their second night upon the road. The piercings were made from the silver rings gathered from the corpses of her family, and Ardal, then a newborn babe, had been found swaddled within the village's stone granary, where someone who'd loved her had hidden her away. Yvain used the water in the wineskin to wash while Ardal took her place, then offered the other woman the same when she finished.
"So it is not a foul sight?"
"No."
Ardal dried her hands on her linens.
"When I look upon his beard, I see that the warrior I have proudly followed for much of my life now hopes to become something more. A warrior sends his enemies into Temra's arms, and so aspires to be like the goddess Rani. But a Ran must speak for all the tribes, and so aspires to be like the best of us."
Not to be the best of his people, but to be like those who were. What mattered was not that Madoc was the finest of them, for one man could never be, but that he would never stop striving toward that goal. Yvain could do a better job of helping him, for she had promised to make him a great king, yet she had put in little effort so far. And knowing Madoc wore his hope and his grief for everyone to see, even when his immediate expression showed neither, made him even more beautiful to her eyes than he had been before. Yvain could not imagine always being laid so bare. In that, she had not as much courage as he. But she did not lack a queen's courage, and that drove her across the clearing. Yvain's roan ate from a small mound of grasses. At the mare's side, Madoc stood with his back to Yvain, flipping her stirrup up over the seat of her saddle. No doubt he heard her approach, but he gave no indication. Instead, she heard the soothing murmur he directed at the mare as his fingers slipped along the girth. She stopped at his shoulder and watched as he began to loosen the knot she'd made. "Did I cinch it too tightly?" That earned her a swift grin, for the day had not yet come when she had cinched it tight enough. Always one of the warriors had to adjust the fit. Then he said,
"It is nearly tight."
And such joy filled her that she was nearly dizzy with it. Perhaps she would never be a warrior queen, but she was stronger than she'd been even a full turn ago. His gaze fell to her wide smile and lingered before he returned his attention to her saddle.
"There is bread and cheese on the gray."
Madoc tipped his head to indicate the horse he would ride.
"Fassad has also found a nest."
Fresh eggs were a fine treat. "Will you have some?" She would feed him from her fingers while he adjusted her saddle if he liked.
"On the road."
"Then I will too. For now there is a lesson owing. You have taught me to make use of what I have as a warrior does, but I have not returned that favor." And even if his lesson had been part of a jest, it had been worth learning. He shot her an amused glance, then lowered the stirrup back into place. Facing her, he crossed his arms over his broad chest. From his towering height, he caught her gaze and silently waited for her to make him a king. She could not think of one thing to say. Her mind raced, collecting all that her mother had ever told her, yet not a single word seemed relevant now. Because those had been conversations, she realized, not simplified lessons. Conversations built upon conversations that stretched back to Yvain's earliest years. Her mother had begun teaching Yvain before she'd ever taken a step. Now she knew not where to start. But perhaps Madoc knew where he ought to. "What would you first want to learn?" He huffed out a soft laugh, but what amused him she couldn't determine, nor did she ask. Instead, she remained quiet as his gaze lifted from hers. He stared out over the tall grasses, as if searching for something in the distance, before looking to her face again.
"We both had parents who taught us valuable lessons from an early age. I cannot think those lessons were so different. Yet you are a queen, and I am only a warrior. What did you learn that I did not?"
How could she answer that? Yvonne struggled to think of what her mother might say, but perhaps that was the difference. Almost everything Yvonne knew was what her mother had told her. But those had not been lessons given, they'd simply been lived. Perhaps, she hesitated a moment, remembering the Parsathian's reaction to how her mother had watched everyone. But Yvonne could not be sorry for it. She and her mother had little else. "Perhaps it is because my mother and I did not only live our own lives. There was the tower, but there were also so many people that we watched, not only royals of other realms or their armies, but Sicyans who went about their lives. Every day my mother would look in on them and describe what they did, what made them laugh or cry, what difficulties they faced, and in that way we added their lives to our own." Madoc seemed frustrated by that answer.
"I have seen others in the same way. I have witnessed their joys and their struggles."
"So until my mother died, perhaps we were the same, both only witnesses to how others lived. But after she was gone..." Yvonne's throat tightened. "No longer could I see outside the tower. And it was as if not only my mother had died, but also everyone we'd watched. They did not know me, but I knew them, and so many were lost to me at once." Madoc grunted softly.
"And you were lonely, not just for your mother, but for them."
"So I was, but I knew they still lived. So instead of grieving, I would imagine what they did each day, and imagining is much more difficult than watching. I would imagine myself in their place, and then have to imagine how they would feel and react. What would bring them joy? What would they fear? What might break their hearts or heal them again? And every time I imagined these things, I felt it too." She clenched her fist over her chest. "As if I were also living those lives. I have been maid, soldier, farmer, noble, thief, miller, magistrate, and so many others. I have been celebrated and I have failed. I have been cruel and kind, corrupt and just. I know not whether my imaginings were those of a fanciful fool, but I think it not much different than what a Ran aspires to be. He must be like the best of his people. I have already been the best and worst of mine." Thoughtfully, he nodded.
"And I have only been a warrior."
"And son, and commander, and friend."
"So I have been, but I have not much imagination beyond my own experience."
"That cannot be true. You would not have won so many battles if you did not understand your opponents and imagine what they might do. You have great capability for imagining. It has simply been directed toward a warrior's purpose." Suddenly lit by amusement, his gaze caught hers.
"Of late, new purpose I have had, and many imaginings I have had of you."
Yvonne's cheeks heated even as happy pleasure skipped across her heart, that tenacious weed reaching for the sun again. As if her blush were a satisfactory response, Madoc grinned, yet made no move toward her.
"So I should imagine myself in another's place."
"That might be a fine start," she agreed, "though not as I did in my tower. No time do you have to lie around and imagine yourself a seamstress. Instead, do it as you speak with others or observe them, as you must have done last eve while talking to the Gogian soldiers and seeing them not as a Parsathian warrior sees them, but as if you were in their place."
"Then this is not truly a new lesson, but one that you taught me last eve. It only requires practice."
"So it does."
"Then I will practice. But for our new lesson..."
His eyes narrowed as if considering before he finally said,
"Had you but one lesson for the Gogian queen, what would it be?"
"That was easy enough. That my father's tyranny should not be admired or imitated." His gaze sharpened on hers.
"Does she admire it?"
5 years past, she did. Beside her, the roan twitched a fat fly from her shoulder. Idly, Yvonne waved the insect away, then smoothed her palm over the mare's glossy coat. "My mother watched her and her brothers closely."
"As a possible match for you?"
Madoc interrupted. "For a time. Though Queen Phyllis married before I even reached a woman's age, it hardly mattered as Yvonne would not have chosen either Phyllis or her brothers. The younger was not so objectionable, but the elder brother was. She and Prince Orin were speaking of unrest in the village and of the farmers who refused to send the full portion of their harvest. Phyllis wished for a queen's guard as strong and as ruthless as my father's guard so they could silence dissent more easily. Orin suggested that she hire Parsathians to do it." Posture abruptly rigid, Matic growled.
If such a request had been made, we'd have helped the farmers tear apart the palace walls.
So they realized.
And Orin said this?
She heard his disbelief, but understood he didn't think that she'd spoken false. Instead, his disbelief stemmed from his familiarity with the prince. Orin had served 2 years upon the lave, leading the company of Gogian soldiers. Matic had dined and fought alongside the other man. He did, Yvain confirmed. A muscle worked in his jaw, anger in every taut line of his body, and Yvain realized she had taught him the wrong thing. Already he knew not to resemble her father in any way. Although it was a lesson the Gogian queen might have benefited from, her people would have benefited more from another. So would Matic. Yet imagine if she had sent her guard to the villages, Yvain told him, then briefly left his side to untie a bag of feed from his saddle. And if instead of—
Give her no more than a handful.
Surprised by the interruption, she frowned at him. What?
The grain,
Matic said. Arms still crossed, his feet planted. He had not moved except to follow her with his gaze.
At the pace we ride, too much feed will shorten her breath and tighten her gut. They can eat their fill at night.
Oh. Amused now, Yvain returned to stand in front of his mountainous form. It is not for the mare.
Are you so hungry, then?
There was a teasing glint in his narrowed eyes. Smiling, she shook her head. You are easily distracted from your lesson. He grinned.
I am.
And unapologetic for it. But she was also too easily distracted, too aware of the pounding of her heart when his gaze fell to her lips. At least if he was watching her mouth, he would not likely note the unsteadiness of her hands as she fumbled with the ties cinching the bag closed.
I am to imagine that she sent her guard to the villages,
Matic said. Distracted, perhaps, but still paying attention. Not to crush them, though. The sack opened and she glanced up to meet his eyes, which were no longer focused on her lips, but seemed intent on the whole of her face. Imagine if she sent them to help the farmers harvest another row. If in the spring she promised to send her guard to plow another field, or if she had hired the Parsathians to help instead of slaughter. For you are more than raiders with swords, and none of you is a stranger to the harvest. Understanding lit his eyes.
That is truth.
So here is your lesson, Matic of Parsath. Holding the sack open between them, she urged. Reach in with one hand and bring out as much as you can. He did so. And even knowing the size of his hands, she had misjudged the amount of grain he might hold cupped in his palm. He drew out such a great heap that the weight of the bag between them was halved. Gripping the edge of the sack tighter, Yvain also reached in and buried her hand deep in the cool, shifting grain. When she drew back, seed slipped over the stumps of her missing fingers, yet still her cupped palm held a fine heap. Whether you rule or lead, she said softly, with your people it is always better to keep an open hand. For even in sour times, with an open hand you will be able to carry them all, and their loyalty will remain with you. But the moment you tighten your grip, no matter how strong or weak you are. Slowly she formed a fist. Matic copied her motion, and grain spilled like a waterfall into the sack. They will begin slipping through your fingers. With seeds raining from his powerful hand, Matic asked quietly,
Is this what your father has done?
It is. She clenched her fist as tight as her strength allowed, then opened her fingers to show him the small number of grains that remained in her palm. He clings to his power and squeezes those still loyal to him, and now there are hardly any left. Abruptly, she frowned as Matic also unrolled his fist. What have you done to your fingers?
It is nothing.
Amusement filled his reply, and perhaps it was a joking lie, or perhaps he believed it was truth, but Yvain could not. She caught his hand and held him still for a closer examination. Multiple bloodied slashes crossed his fingers and palm, as if he'd repeatedly gripped a knife by the blade. But not a blade, she realized. Gently she drew her fingertips down the strong lengths of his fingers, brushing away the grains that stuck to the shallow wounds. This is from the grass you cut to feed the horses? Matic grunted. Sudden and hot tension gripped her body. That sound had been confirmation and more. She could not always decipher his grunted replies, but his arousal she could, for her own rose quickly to meet it. So quickly. In a single breath, concern for his injury dropped away and so many imaginings replaced it, of sucking his fingers into her mouth, of watching his need burn until he begged her to do the same to his cock, of urging his hand down between her thighs where she was slick and aching so that he might ease her need as he had the night before. But that would not disentangle her heart from his. Even as Maddock curled his fingers over hers as if to catch her hand and drag her closer, Yvain slipped out of his grasp, stepping back and beyond his reach. Agitated, her body trapped in a hectic rush of pulsing blood and prickling skin, she folded her arms over her chest and tried to hold her rioting emotions within her breast. Yet despite that effort, or because of it, her voice emerged in a strained whisper. "This lesson is done." Maddock would teach her another. His fiery gaze and the primal stillness of his body promised it without words. But he would not teach her now, for he only gave a sharp nod and said,
"Then prepare to ride."
He strode away, his arousal still etched in harsh lines upon his face and his erection jutting behind his red linens. Though every warrior must see him and know what it meant, nothing did he conceal or repress. If Maddock felt any affection for her, if there was any hope of love or trust, anything beyond lust, he would not likely conceal that either. And she saw nothing of the sort. But it mattered not. Hers would surely wither soon.
Chapter 18. Maddock. Maddock's bride was truly a southerner, for she loved to build walls. He had not attempted to breach the wall of silence she'd erected that morning. Her punishment was one he'd well deserved. Yet several walls remained even after she'd begun speaking to him again, and Maddock was truly a Parsathian, for he could not resist the challenge they presented. Not a moment passed that he did not imagine ways to climb over them or break through them or dig beneath them. For there was little else to do on this journey, and her walls filled him with hot frustration. Yet Maddock would not need to breach them at all if he could lure her out. First, the wall that she intended to put between their beds until her moon night. That one required patience, because she claimed not to fear him, yet he could not mistake the way she'd stiffened and pulled away from his hands. She no longer punished him for pulling at her tongue, and he'd seen how his touch still heated her blood, yet he'd foolishly damaged the one easy bond they'd forged between them, a bond forged by mutual desire. The repair there was his alone to make, and it would take time. Yet now there was another bond. She would teach him to be a king, and he would teach her to be a warrior. So when they took to the road again and she put up yet another wall that was made of short responses, tight smiles, and averted eyes, Maddock had bait that Yvain could not resist.
"Another lesson," he said to her. "Before any Parsathian becomes a warrior, first she must learn to hunt. If you ever wish to become a warrior queen, you must look with the hunter's eyes."
Those moonstone eyes were not a hunter's yet and gazed at him full of wariness and doubt. He saw none of the joy of that morning's lesson before she nodded. "How does a hunter see, then?" As Maddock did. He showed to her the mounds of earth that told him of the giant rodents burrowed beneath them, the quivering stalks in the fields that said long-toothed cats slinked between them, the large and shallow depressions in the mud where heavy reptiles bedded down for the night. Every marking in the soil, every broken stem or twitch of a leaf, every disturbance that was not created by the wind or the rain, they all told him of creatures that might be hunted or that might be hunting them. Her eyes brightened all the while as she began looking anew. As the sun dipped toward the west, it was no longer Maddock pointing to what she should see, but Yvain noting each marking and asking him what he made of them. Until she was not always asking, but seeing for herself. "That trail there," she said, indicating a swath through the long grasses. "It is as wide as the trail made by Mirans, but those stalks are flattened and these are cut short, as if by a scythe." Maddock grunted his approval.
"Well seen."
Pleasure flushed her cheeks. "But it could not be a scythe, could it? What else could do that?"
He could name many creatures, but only one of that size.
"A giant millipede, which also tells us there is likely a stream nearby. They are usually near water, or areas where the ground remains moist."
"A millipede?" Eagerly she glanced at the path. "I've heard they are tasty." Maddock grinned. His bride had claimed he only saw a person's weaknesses, and he thought it fair to say that Yvain's stomach was her greatest one.
"We will hunt a millipede only after you have had more practice."
She shot him a curious look. "Are they a danger to us? I thought they only ate vegetation."
"They do, but they are not defenseless. Jaws that slice through grass can slice through flesh, and some millipedes emit a foul musk that burns the skin,"
he told her, frowning, as for the first time since their lesson had begun, Yvain glanced distractedly behind them. She faced forward again as Keeler called out,
"I would not object to millipede this night if she would observe the hunt instead of joining it."
All of the warriors had been invested in her lesson this day, though they had not interrupted Maddock's teaching.
Now she looked to Matic hopefully, clearly wanting to watch them hunt, before her brow furrowed and she turned again.
"What is it?"
Matic asked, suddenly caring nothing of hunts and millipedes.
"A chill?"
"Not a chill, I..." Her uneasy gaze searched the road behind them. "I know not what it is, as if something comes." He held up a fist and the others immediately halted, falling silent and listening. Matic heard nothing but what he expected to hear. He looked to Fassad, who was studying his wolves. The other warrior shook his head. The dog sensed nothing. Yet they had not at the ruins either. His bride was more sensitive to magics than they.
"How near, my lady?"
Bannock asked her softly. A needed apology filled her reply. "I am no good judge of distance, but it does not feel close, only coming."
"Then we will put more distance between us,"
Matic said grimly, for he had ignored Yvain's instinct once, never would he again. They rode hard until nightfall, when Yvain said she could no longer feel the presence behind them. Matic knew not if that meant they had merely outpaced it or if it no longer followed, and it mattered little either way. No more easy nights could be had. Even if the magic Yvain had sensed was no threat, if her brother's soldiers had taken the southern route along the river, they might soon be. When they came across a copse near a stream, Matic called a halt. The trees provided better shelter than the long grasses did, and could be climbed for a better vantage, and the monkeys that chattered and screeched overhead suggested that whatever stalked their party had not yet befouled this spot. While the others made camp, he and Keeler rode a wide perimeter searching for any threat. Beyond a long-toothed cat, which the wolves would alert them to if it approached the copse, there was little. Still, Matic knew Keeler was as unsettled as he. Yvain's vague unease was something they'd both heard from others before, during the campaign against Stranix Fang, when dark priests used their foul magic from afar. If so, they had much to be worried about. Yet he would not assume that was what she sensed. It might have been like the wraiths at the ruins, dangerous yet well behind them now. And if dark magic stalked them, they would face that threat when it came. He saw the same remembrance upon Bannock's and Ardal's faces when he returned to camp, as well as the same determination not to make early assumptions. And he saw that a hunt had been completed after all. A small millipede roasted over the fire. Brought down by Turek, he quickly learned, when Yvain happily recounted that young warrior's victory, and that he'd shown her how to pester the millipede from a distance until it rolled into a ball, then safely pierce the creature's segmented carapace with a spear. The jealousy that roared through Matic then was fierce and fanged and as foul as the magic that stalked them. He knew Turek had taken a sweet liking to his bride, yet never would the warrior act upon it. Matic believed that Yvain never would either. Her ambitions were too great, and she would not risk their marriage with an idle flirtation. And Matic himself had encouraged her to seek affection from anyone but him. She'd befriended all of his warriors. He should not resent Turek hunting a millipede for her, or Ardal receiving her smile, or Bannock sharing in her laugh. Yet he did resent them all, furiously. Wordlessly, he left again to care for his horse, hating the unworthy emotion burning in his chest, hating the frustration that put it there. Because with him, Yvain built walls, and as far as he could see, she had raised none between herself and his dragon. It should matter not at all what she did. Such turmoil should not be raging within him. She was but a vessel, a tool for his vengeance. And he was a thrice-cursed fool to feel such resentment and jealousy and fury. None served him well. But his dragon guard did, and Yvain did too. From nearly the moment they'd met, she'd guided him toward becoming a better king. Now she might serve as warning against a danger that none of their eyes could see. A piercing shriek sounded as he returned to camp, yet the shrill noise, and Yvain's startled scream in response, only made him grin. That horrible shrieking signaled that their dinner was ready, as steam whistled from the millipede's carapace. His warriors' laughter greeted him at the fire, and they each screamed in turn to match Yvain's. She sat giggling, facing the flames with her saddle bracing her back as the others did. Dropping his saddle onto the ground, Matic took his place beside her. She glanced at him, the warmth of the fire reflecting in her pale eyes. But when she spoke, it was directed to Turek, apparently in response to one of the endless questions he always had for her during their meals. "You have seen the Tower of the Moon in Ephorn?" she asked him, and the young warrior nodded. "It is much the same."
"What is the same?"
Matic accepted the bowl of water Fassad passed to him, then quickly tore off a few of the millipede's spiky legs and dropped them in.
"She is telling us of Sissia,"
Turek said. Eagerly, she watched the legs hiss in the water before looking to Matic.
Have you been?
Only through the Outlands, never to the Queen City. Only I have been,
Bannock said.
The Sissian Tower resembles the Ephorn Tower in appearance, but the Sissian is much larger.
Because we knew the tale of Ranbantic stealing the pearl from the Moon Tower, Yvain said, grinning. My foremother would not risk the same, so she built hers much taller.
Do you also keep your treasures at the top?
The old raider asked. Yvain shook her head. It is the chamber where I was imprisoned, where my mother and I were. Maddox's mother too, but he would not spoil the mood by saying so. He only poked at the legs, though the way they floated told him they had not yet cooled enough to eat. It was Keeler who said what Matic probably should have.
So there was treasure at the top.
Then Matic was glad he'd not said it because Keeler's comment might have pleased a barmaid, but it only brought a frown to Yvain's face. I am not Sissia's treasure. Her people are. Matic grinned as he realized how fully she'd misunderstood Keeler's meaning.
When we speak of Ranbantic stealing the pearl, sometimes that pearl refers to the king's daughter, whom he also stole from that tower.
Oh. A blush colored her cheeks as if she recalled what else Matic had called a pearl, yet amusement danced in her eyes. So he scaled the walls to have her?
And stole her away to the burning plains.
As Matic intended to do with his own bride. Yet there the similarity ended, as Yvain must have realized as well. For although she smiled faintly, the amusement in her eyes dimmed. He must have loved her very much to attempt such a dangerous feat.
The legends say nothing of love,
Matic told her and plucked a leg from the water.
Only that after Ranbantic saw her beauty, he could not resist it.
Keeler laughed.
And if all that remains of her in legend is a pearl, I dare say it wasn't the beauty of her face that Ranbantic could not resist.
A pearl was not all that remained of Ranbantic's queen. Her blood ran just as strong through Maddox's line as the Thief King's did. Yet he did not need to explain that to Yvain. Her own line celebrated warrior queens whose lovers were rarely even acknowledged in their legends. So he only said to Yvain,
The story of the pearl is but good for feasts and song. Ranbantic's true legacy was in uniting the tribes.
And defeating the Scourge. Her hungry gaze was locked on the millipede's leg as Maddox snapped off the pointed tip and gave it to her. I've heard that tale. Though not how he united them, only that he did. She mimicked Matic when he demonstrated how to suck out the sweet, buttery jelly, her full lips wrapping around the broken tip. Her cheeks hollowed and her gaze widened with delight, then Bliss closed her eyes as she sucked fiercely on the leg. Hanan, be merciful. The ravenous, pleasured sounds she made could stiffen a corpse. In full arousal, Matic stared at her, dimly aware of Ardal's snort and playful shove at Torek, who also stared, and of Keeler muffling his laughter and burying his face in his hands. Yvain was oblivious to them all. Until beside her, Danos said,
Ranbantic, the Thief King, was born squalling upon Temra's altar.
Yvain's eyes flew open, less likely because of the warrior's words, but because of their rarity. Then Bannock, who sat at Danos' other side, spoke next, and Yvain's attention followed.
Unburned the plains were, yet fires of war divided the 13 tribes.
The old warrior recited. Then came Torek, his cheeks hot and gaze averted.
The embattled clans allowed silver-fingered Rani no rest.
Countless riders she took, Ardal said next, eyes spitting lightning, spilling tears of rain.
She carried them upon her dragon into Temra's waiting arms,
Keeler said. Fasad continued.
Over the Astal Mountains she flew, but one knight was unseated.
It had come Matic's turn, and Yvain's enraptured gaze moved to his face. He snapped off another leg tip and gave it to her, speaking the words he'd known longer than any others.
From the sky she plunged, for the flaming peaks had erupted the scourge.
Danna started the round again.
Spitting fire, the demon consumed flesh of dragon and riders.
The scourge turned ravenous fiery eyes to the unburned plains. With tears streaming, Rani sped to warn the northern tribes and clans.
Countless warriors fell before the demon, breaking their blades on obsidian skin.
Her dragon lost, Rani could not fly the newly fallen into Temra's arms. She implored the embattled tribes to unite against the demon scourge.
Matic recited gravely,
Where the plains would become a realm of blood and ashes.
Eyes wide after that dire warning, Yvain eagerly looked to Danna, who continued,
Hearing her, he who was not yet Thief King looked weeping upon the burning plains.
Of 13 tribes, only 7 remained, and a grieving Bantic, the last of his. With torn heart, he called upon the clans to unite, but they listened not to his voice.
Too many years the tribes had warred, too many warriors had been lost to battle.
Too many lies had been spoken,
Keeler said softly.
Too many oaths had been broken. So the 7 tribes only united in fleeing west before the demon scourge. There, upon Temra's sacred altar,
as that goddess had, Matic pounded his fist into the ground.
Ran Bantic vowed to always speak truth.
From the tribes he asked warriors to come and speak for their clans.
They also vowed to speak truth, never to break an oath or use sly tongue. Each clan listened to their own warriors and trusted the words spoken.
They in turn each listened to Bantic, he who was not yet Thief King.
To the glass fields he led them, and the demon's fire turned night into day. 7 tribes united. The warriors flew into battle as one with their mounts.
Keeping rhythm with the recitation, Yvenne's gaze moved to Maddox's face. As it always did, passion and triumph filled his chest as he spoke the next verse.
And the scourge fell before Bantic and the riders of the burning plains.
As the demon lay dying, the tribe spoke as one, and Ran Bantic he became.
Rani touched Ran Bantic with her quick and cunning, and a thief king he became. Then splitting open the stomach of the scourge, she reclaimed her swift dragon.
Carrying the countless dead, silver-fingered Rani finally flew them into Temra's arms.
And from Temra's scorched skin grew the fire bloom, as red as blood spilled, as red as fire burns. To remind the tribes never to be divided, only to ride united, and only to speak truth.
Fassad said in solemn voice. Sucking on yet another leg, though more quietly now, Yvenne looked to Matic, who had counted the remaining verses and filled his mouth with jelly. With a frown, she pulled the leg from between her pursed lips. You broke the rhythm! He grinned at her as the others laughed.
It is done.
Done? It cannot be. No mention was even made of how Rani rebreathed life into her dragon, or how the 6 other tribes chose the warriors who became Ran Bantic's first dragon guard.
It was but the opening song.
Matic admitted.
The full legend of the Scourge requires 3 days to tell.
That only slightly mollified his bride. Then at least say how Ran Bantic destroyed the demon. Matic's grin widened because he knew of no one who did not ask the same after first hearing the tale.
By uniting the tribes.
Yes, but was it with sword, spear, a baleful stare? She bestowed her own upon him.
By uniting the tribes.
Matic repeated more gravely this time.
The method matters not at all because the scourge could not have been slain if the riders had not stood together as one.
Heavily she sighed, then her eyes narrowed. So Parsathians know full well the value of an alliance.
We do, as we know it is only strong if allies all speak true and keep their vows.
And those in the Great Alliance did not. But unlike this morning, Yvenne made no earnest claim that she would not lie to him and never had. Instead, her face shuddered, and she looked away from him. Maddox's jaw clenched. Another wall she put up between them. But this one she seemed to think was of his making. He'd been unforgivably wrong last night in their bed when he'd snatched her tongue. Now he believed she'd spoken truth then. He'd also accepted her claim that she hadn't conspired to murder his parents. But was he supposed to forget other times she'd spoken with a sly tongue of her insistence that his mother approved of her as his bride? Was he to believe that while his mother had been imprisoned and interrogated and raped and beheaded, she'd given Yvenne her son to wed? He could not, so that wall would stand. To the others, she asked, the tribe spoke as one voice to name Ran Bantic king. What if they do not speak as one voice to name Matic? Are there others who might be named? Others she believed might be a better king or a better suitor? Foul jealousy speared him again. Silently, he tore away the white meat from within the millipede's steaming carapace. The warriors looked to Matic, deferring the answer to him, but when he gave none, it was Ardal who spoke. Each tribe can put forth a candidate, but they will only name Matic. Because he is of Ran Bantic's line?
No.
Irritatedly, Matic answered her now.
My father was not of Ran Bantic's line, and yet he was named Ran before he married my mother, and then she was also named. Our Ran are not chosen by blood, but by who has proven capable of leading, as I have upon the banks of the Lave.
She looked to him then with sharp amusement. But were you not named commander of the Parsathian army because you were the son of 2 Ran?
Perhaps my mother looked to me first for that reason.
And because his parents had made certain he would learn the lessons Aran needed to know.
But she would not have looked to me at all if I hadn't proved myself in the campaign against Stranix Fang, and if the other riders did not agree, they would have spoken out against me.
Bannock nodded.
We would have. Whether leading warriors or all of the tribes, he must have the support of the people.
But surely the tribes are not always in agreement. What if some dissent?
As two did when we joined the Great Alliance?
Bannock asked.
Our queen and king heard and considered what they had to say. That is also the Rand's duty and his respect for the people, to listen, for he knows they will only come to him speaking truth.
Her expression tightened. Listening to someone's words shows respect. The older warrior nodded. What if he has heard them and still there is disagreement?
Then he must speak his own truth and attempt to persuade them, as Ran Ashev and Ran Marek persuaded the tribes when the alliance was created.
And if they aren't persuaded? Bannock shrugged.
They might challenge him if the matter is one of importance. If it is a lesser matter, they might give him their silence so all will know that he does not speak for them.
Give him their silence? If Aran speaks for all, that must be a great insult.
Not insult, punishment. It is the Ran's honor to hear his people and to speak for them. If he cannot, it makes him not the leader he aspires to be, one who serves all.
Her face softened. That is also what my mother said, that a Sisian queen must serve all. But if a Parsathian king cannot, what must be done then?
He must think carefully over what was said,
Maddox said to her, because this lesson had been taught to him many times.
He might also consult others and seek their wisdom and counsel, or sometimes he must simply wait until they speak to him again. Sometimes he must wait a full morning,
Keeler said, grinning. Yvain blinked. Only a morning? Parsathian disagreements are resolved so quickly?
He refers to this morning's punishments,
Maddox told her. She looked to the other warriors, wide-eyed. You punished him? Keeler snorted.
Not as well as we thought. Ours was nothing to yours.
Full-on laughter from all greeted that statement, yet Yvain only looked at them with bafflement. Mine? A full morning! Artle choked out, tears in her eyes as she laughed, riding beside him with not a word spoken. Realization filled her gaze as it swept to Maddox. You thought I punished you? At his nod, her eyebrows arched. I would not punish you with silence. If you anger me, I will tell you so. As he ought to have realized, he'd assumed her silence was punishment because that was what he knew as a Parsathian. Yet he should have remembered how quiet she'd been when his warriors had punished her at the table last eve, and how very lonely she'd appeared before he'd joined her. He ought to have recalled what she'd said before of how agonizing loneliness was, and he should have thought of how he'd yet to hear her make a sound of discomfort, though many times on this journey she'd been in pain. Her silence did not mean punishment. It meant she was hurt. All this morning she had been. Maddox did not believe it was her shattered knee that had pained her. Often it must have, yet she'd still spoken to him.
So what reason for your silence?
A careless shrug lifted her shoulders, yet his question stole the light from her eyes. I only wish to be left to my own thoughts. Thoughts of what hurt her, no doubt, but also thoughts she clearly had no wish to share. Maddox could allow her that, as there was much he did not wish to share either, such as the hot jealousy within him or the clenching of his chest whenever he recalled Yvain saying she regretted her choice of husband.
I imagine a queen has many clever thoughts to occupy her,
Torek said, blushing more deeply with every word.
More clever thoughts than the king she will marry,
Keeler observed, earning a grunt of agreement from Maddox and a laugh from the others.
So your bride will have long silences like Danos.
The mention roused the quiet warrior. Frowning, Dana looked up from her plate.
I do not wish to be left to my thoughts. I hold my tongue out of habit.
Keeler appeared chagrined for teasing her. With a nod, he stuffed his mouth full. The others looked everywhere but at Dana, except for Yvain, who waited for more explanation. When none came forth, she asked for it. Habit because you hunt so often? Dana shook her head.
The habit of not saying words best left unspoken.
Yvain's curiosity sharpened. Do you often want to?
When I was a girl, quite often. Now the desire is gone, but the habit is left. Until we see your mother again, Artle said dryly. Then the desire will likely return.
Dano's grin flashed.
Screaming at her is only habit, too. Once I believed it would make her hear me, but she only hears my father, and that will never change.
With a heavy sigh, Bannock shook his head. Uncertainty pinched Yvain's mouth as she glanced from him to Danil, clearly wondering what she meant by that, but also clearly sensing that tender ground was being tread upon. Danil caught that uncertain glance.
My father was one of the Destroyer's warlords.
And the Destroyer's armies violated all they defeated. Yet it was the female warriors who'd had to bear more than the pain and humiliation of their rape.
I see.
Sympathy and understanding warmed Yvain's response.
We cannot always choose our fathers or heal our mothers.
A slight smile curved Danil's mouth.
No, we cannot, she agreed. And something in my mother was injured more deeply than in others. Most warriors took the half-moon milk afterward. There were some who wanted a child and cared not how it came to be. My mother, she would not take the half-moon milk, but neither did she want me. So I spent many years wondering why give birth to me if only to hate me and beat me, and I was angry for it.
It was a disgrace,
Bannock muttered.
Both what she did to you and how long it took others in your clan to see.
I was almost a hunter's age before I was taken from her, she said to Yvain. But in those early years, after the Destroyer, many were blinded by grief and pain. How many were lost? How many violated? It must have been difficult to see through that to one young girl.
You are more forgiving than you should be,
the old warrior told her.
You were right to be angry.
And angry I was,
Danil shrugged,
until she told me that she gave birth to me because the only way she could make my father pay for what he did to her was by making his child pay.
Anger tightened Maddox's jaw.
Such words should never be spoken.
I'm glad they were spoken,
Danil replied with an unexpected laugh.
I wanted her to be a mother as yours was, and yours, and yours.
She looked at Keeler and then Torek.
But after she told me that, I knew she would never, and I stopped wishing for what could not be.
As every warrior should. Still, Maddox shook his head because it should not have been so.
I feel no anger toward her now, she continued. I pity her. My mother is a warrior through and through, and she makes use of what she has. But the Destroyer's warlord did not leave her much.
He did not.
Bannock agreed softly.
So that is the story of my mother,
Danil said, as she turned again to Yvain.
And your mother killed the warlord who was my father. So I ask Bannock for more tales of her than of any other, and I would rather hear new songs of Queen Visenne fighting the Destroyer's armies than another of Rand Bantic.
If there are songs about my mother, I know none of them, and I hope Bannock will share them with me one day.
That I will, my lady. Now?
Perhaps another night, as those songs will only be new to me, not to Danil. Yvain looked to the warrior beside her. My favorite tale about my mother is not likely one you've heard, as it happened after the alliance was formed, after she slew the demon queen, after she was imprisoned in the tower. The poison weakened her body, and she was weakened further after giving birth to Lazen. Still, whenever my father tried to visit her bed to get more sons upon her, she tried to kill him, so he had her tied down before his visits to the tower.
By your father's personal guards?
The same who'd helped rape Maddox's mother. Yvain nodded.
We will kill them all.
He vowed softly. A pleased smile curved her full mouth before she returned her attention to Danil. When Ezel was born, my mother bled an ocean of blood, and for many days afterward she did not open her eyes. Even after she awakened, however, it was as if her mind was no longer there. She had to be fed and cleaned and dressed as a babe, and she never spoke or moved from her bed. Still, my father tied her, for he feared it was a deception. When Bazir was born, she made no sound, but lay in silent labor until he emerged, screaming from between her legs. When Cezanne was born, it was the same. Her body labored, but she made no sound of pain. Still, my father had her tied. But one night, either the guards who secured the knots were careless or the knots loosened while he rutted, and in the moment when my father spent his seed, when he was most unguarded, my mother grabbed hold of his hair and with her teeth ripped out his throat. Maddox gave an approving grunt and saw his enjoyment in this tale reflected on every other warrior's expression, and Yvain's too. Her face was alight as she continued. She failed to kill him, but he bears a horrid scar. Through 3 winters and 2 births, she lay in bed, made no sounds, gave no indication that anything still remained of her mind. Yet every night, she secretly moved about the tower to keep up what little strength was left after the poisoning. Yvain sighed. She claimed it was her speed that failed her. She meant to tear his jugular, yet she was too slow, so he pulled his head back just enough to save himself, and her weakened arms could not drag him back down to finish him.
It is still a legendary feat,
Danil said in awe.
Such patience she had.
Yvain nodded.
She told me his blood was the sweetest she'd ever tasted, his blood and his fear. She paused to suck the jelly from another leg. He did not visit her bed again for some time, but he did not need to. I was conceived that night. A product of endless patience and cunning deception, with her mother bathed in her father's blood, Maddock thought that beginning fit his bride very well.
"If ever you were silent longer than a morning, should I fear that you intend to kill me?"
She laughed at him. "My mother taught me better than that. I would give you no warning at all." He grinned.
"You jest, my lady," Artle said from the other side of the fire. "But I believe you also speak absolute truth."
So did Maddock. When Yven left camp to piss, Maddock sent both Dana and Artle with her. Whether magic followed them or Raguzian soldiers did, greater precautions he would take with her every movement. He unrolled his furs to make her bed. Only Yven would sleep a full night that night and every night following. For the others, a half-night sleep would be had, with at least three warriors on watch at every moment. But Maddock suspected he would sleep even fewer hours than that. Much he had learned about his bride this day, yet still she hid much behind her walls. When she returned to camp, her limp was more pronounced, as it often was after a hard day's ride, yet the remainder of her saddle stiffness appeared to have gone. She looked to his face as she approached her bed. Little could he read in hers. Hot frustration poured through his veins again. He strove not to let it command his tongue as he narrowed his eyes upon her and asked in teasing tone,
"Do you lie in wait as your mother did?"
The comparison to her mother pleased her, he saw, though confusion wrinkled her brow. "How do you mean?"
"Silently. Not once have I heard you make a sound of pain."
His warriors loved to groan, even over a splinter. Especially over a splinter. When a wound was worse, hardly any complaint would come at all. But Yven was not a warrior yet. A faint smile touched her mouth, yet her eyes remained solemn. A queen does not cry when there is someone to witness her tears. He frowned. No shame could be had in crying.
"Why?"
Whatever pain a queen suffers, her people suffer worse, and the role of comfort should not fall upon their shoulders but hers. Far different from the Parsathian role, Aran spoke for all, so he also spoke for their grief, sometimes only with his tears.
"What if it is not to weep in pain but to scream in pain?"
"It is the same," she said. "A queen's pain is nothing to what her people know."
"Even when your knee was shattered, you were silent?"
Maddock did not think he could have been. "I was." A shadow passed over her face, also to deny their satisfaction.
"Whose?"
Though he suspected, only her brothers and father did she know. Her silence answered him. Was she hurt again, or silent for another reason? It could not be about Maddock's mother. The injury was too old. 3 years, she'd said, the same number of years Queen Visenne had been dead.
"Why will you not tell me what happened? What do you conceal?"
Her eyes hardened. "If you believe I have something to hide, will you trust that what I reveal is truth? You will not, so I cannot see what purpose there would be in telling you when you doubt all that I say. I will gain nothing, yet you will gain another weapon to use against me, one that wounds me deeper than any other." He could make no sense of her, not of her words and not when she turned from him and began to limp away. Maddock caught her arm.
"Where do you go?"
She spoke low enough that the others would not hear, but firmly enough that he could not mistake her. "There is but one bed, and I will not share yours." Maddock had not forgotten. She would deny his place at her side until her moon night, so this bed he'd made for her alone. Though he'd hoped she would change her mind.
"There will be no wolves to warm you this night. They must watch over the camp."
Her chin lifted. "I will be warm enough by the fire." In her heavy cloak, perhaps she would. Unlike the previous eve when she'd worn nothing beneath it, now she was also wrapped in her linens and covered by a silk robe. As they neared the boiling sea, the spring nights became ever more humid and mild. But if one of them must keep warm by the fire, it would not be his bride.
"The furs are for your use," he told her. "I am on watch as well."
She turned back toward him, but it was only partial acceptance. "You will need a bed half the night through. Wake me and I will take my turn at watch while you sleep."
"Last eve, you asked me to wake you for another reason."
She went still, her gaze locked on his. "To ease your need?" Which was suddenly hard upon him. With blood pounding, he snagged the braid at the base of her neck and tugged her closer. She came easily, lips parted, eyes widened. Arousal roughened his voice.
"Last eve, you would have taken me into your mouth."
With a lift of her chin, she said, "So I would now if you demand it." If he demanded it,
Not if he asked, because she would refuse, but if he demanded, she would comply. And Matic could not tell if the fire burning in her moonstone gaze was challenge or desire. All that he could read clearly from her face was that Yvonne would ease his need if he told her to. She would go to her knees, even if the shattered joint pained her, and not make a sound but for the hiss of her breath. So a decision must be made. He could tighten his fist in her hair and guide her down and know the hot ecstasy of her mouth upon his cock, or he could open his hand. Releasing her braid, he cupped her jaw in his palm, rubbed his thumb over the fullness of her bottom lip.
That is not what I would ask of you this eve. Instead, I would ease your need.
It was a lure to bring her out from behind her walls, a lure that would give him as much pleasure as it did her. But although temptation shone through her gaze, she shook her head. You have shown me how to ease my own.
Not with your fingers, with my mouth upon your cunt.
No mistaking the emotion that flared through her eyes now. Pure hunger, he saw, as fiery as his own.
Beneath our furs I would taste your lips and every span of your skin until honey dripped between your thighs. Then I would feast upon the sweetness of you far into the night.
Her breath stopped and she squeezed her eyes shut. With that moonstone gaze shielded, he could better see her face, the flush upon her cheeks, the moistness of her lips. He could see the effort it took her to pull away from him. On my moon night, she whispered, her face averted, her body tense. I will be better prepared for you then.
Prepared to meet the lust that raged through him?
Matic did not think she could be. With a soft laugh, he let her go.
Then take your sleep while you can,
he told her.
You will need it.
Chapter 19. Yvonne.
The stars still shone brightly overhead when Yvonne opened her eyes, uncertain of what had awakened her until she heard it again. A soft snort, as the horses sometimes made, but this was near her head and accompanied by shuffling and grunting. Maddox's low voice came from just as nearby, but at her other side.
It is only a louth.
Rooting in the soil, with the short tusks alongside its beak. An odd-looking creature it was, the size of a boar, but with its squat body low to the ground, four legs splayed like a newt's, and with smooth reptilian skin. She turned away from the louth to study Matic, who sat beside her bed. It was closer to morning than she'd thought. The stars above were bright, but they faded to the east. Almost dawn, yet he still seemed to be on watch. At the center of the camp, the fire burned low, flames glinting off the knife he used. So different he looked by firelight, the soft glow making his features seem more harsh, all hardened planes and angles with deep and dark shadows, yet still so handsome to her eyes. For a long breath she watched him, trying to fathom what he was doing, and trying not to recall how many times she'd silently eased her need in these furs the previous night, her mind filled with his roughened voice telling her that he would feast upon her cunt, then falling asleep lonely, wishing she'd invited him into their bed. Even now she longed to invite him in, to know the pleasure he promised. But pleasure was not all she longed for, and the soft pain beneath her breast reminded her that she was supposed to be disentangling her emotions. But there was no purpose served by lingering in the furs. She would only wish for what she could not have. Still, there were others sleeping, so her voice was a soft whisper as she sat up and asked, "What is it that you are scraping?"
"A stave for a bow."
His reply was as quiet as hers. Fascinated, she watched him. His mother had once made a similar stave with wood painstakingly carved from the frame of Yvonne's bed, yet Ranashev had possessed no blade to do it with, only a bone comb sharpened against the tower walls. Matic finished with the knife and collected a twisted length of cord. Bending the bow, he quickly strung it. He examined the weapon, then tested it by drawing the string. Finally, he nodded, as if satisfied.
"It is too green, but will serve to strengthen your arm."
Confusion filled her. "My arm?" A soft grunt was his answer, and he held the weapon out to her. Yvonne took it, her heart pounding sickly. In her left hand, she gripped the bow. With the fingers remaining on her right hand, she plucked the string, loving the memory of wielding this weapon. But she could no longer. "I can barely draw the string." She showed him how difficult it was, "and I cannot do it at all while also trying to notch an arrow." Matic watched her struggle with the bowstring before meeting her eyes with a dark, even gaze.
"Use your other hand."
"But that is not..." "What your mother taught me." Yvonne bit off those unintended words before they could be spoken. He must have known, but she saw no anger in his expression, only patience.
"You are not the first to lose fingers, or even a full hand, and most warriors have one arm stronger than the other. But a warrior queen should learn to use both equally well. So you will.
A warrior queen. She'd believed Matic meant it as a joke, yet now he gave her a bow and claimed she would use it. Throat suddenly thick and aching, she grasped the stave in her right hand. It was awkward, for she could not firmly grip the wood with only two frail fingers and a thumb, and the bow wobbled in her grip when she tried to draw the string. Her left hand and arm were untrained and weak. Yet Matic had given her this to strengthen them, so that she might one day wield a bow and arrow again. A queen did not cry when there was someone to see, yet never had Yvain struggled so hard against tears. Her chest was achingly full and her vision blurred when Matic came nearer, adjusting her fingers around the bow.
By wrapping leather here, I can make a grip that will conform to your remaining fingers and give you a stable hold,
he said quietly, reinforcing her grip now by curling his fingers over hers.
Try to draw.
She did, and could barely pull the string. Matic grunted. Despite her poor showing, that response sounded to her like approval, or perhaps barely was better than he expected.
Build your strength by pulling on the string as you ride. In time, you'll need a vambrace to protect your forearm, but you are not drawing hard enough to bother with it now. Best to tie your sleeves out of the way, though, and you must practice.
I will, she vowed, her voice a thick rasp. She felt Maddox's gaze upon her, but could not look at him. His big hand tightened over hers.
Do you sense the same thing you did last eve?
Yvain shook her head. Maddox seemed unsurprised by that answer.
I will finish the grip while you break your fast and make ready to ride,
he said gruffly. Silently she nodded, then moved in haste away from him, her heart painfully swollen within her chest. She was supposed to be disentangling her emotions, separating lust from love. She was supposed to let all her hope wither. Her would-be husband did not make it easy. Chapter 20. Yvain. Also not easy was drawing a bow while riding a horse. Yvain didn't rely on the reins for balance, yet they seemed to offer some small measure of control over her mount, so letting go of the reins sent Yvain's heart to racing. Then pulling on the bowstring shifted her weight in the saddle, making her instinctively grip more tightly with her legs, and she had not yet broken the habit. Every moment she expected the animal to bolt forward, sending her tumbling over the mare's rump. One day she would gallop along and shoot her arrows without fear. But that was not this day. Instead, she practiced every time they slowed the horses to a walk. Beside her, Matic observed,
Soon your shoulders will feel as your ass did the first day in the saddle.
She knew they would, just as her shoulders and arms had ached in the days following Ranashev's first lessons. And those lessons had culminated in the death of her oldest brother. Now she dreamed these practices would culminate in an arrow through her father's neck, a dream that had seemed impossible until this very morning, when Matic had given her this bow, as if her missing fingers had changed nothing at all. Grinning happily, Yvain replied, I have not a care. She knew not when Matic's grin had become more handsome than his scowl, yet she could hardly look away from him. But with effort she did, focusing on the road ahead. Matic brought her attention back round by asking,
What occupies your thoughts this morn?
Because she had been nearly as silent as yesterday, when he believed she punished him. Staying in the saddle, said she. For they had pushed harder upon the road, and she was not yet confident enough to focus on anything but riding when they struck a faster pace. But it was only a partial truth. And thinking that as much as my mother described to me of the world outside our tower room, I cannot truly understand many things until I have experienced or seen them for myself.
Such as?
Such as longing and desire, or the stairs. Yet all of those answers made her heart constrict, so instead she gestured to the southwest, where a herd of hump-backed reptiles with long necks were walking north in single file. I thought a whiptail would be larger than a mammoth.
They are. It is only the distance that makes them appear smaller,
Matic said, and pointed to a nearby cluster of palms.
As we ride closer, you will see they stand taller than those trees.
She looked again in amazement. Since she had left her tower, Yvain's eager eyes had taken in everything that had only been described to her before. She had looked and looked and looked, desperate to see it all for herself. Yet until Matic rode beside her, she hadn't realized how much she'd been blind to or how often she'd misunderstood what lay before her, because she didn't know how to see. Yesterday he'd begun teaching her to see as a hunter saw. She had not believed then that he truly meant to make a warrior queen of her, but it had been another lesson she'd been glad to learn. And now it was not a joke, but truth. Remembrance sent a thrill of pleasure coursing through her. If I had an arrow, what could I shoot today for our supper? As the other warriors did, they often loosed arrows from their saddles and rode over to sweep up their kill without dismounting.
A pheasant, he replied, or a marmot?
A marmot? She looked to him in surprise. Except for the millipede the previous eve, always the other warriors took small game. Something so big?
You are thinking of the hooded marmot from the Ephorn Forest. These are the size of a dally bird.
You've seen sign of them today? He nodded.
I'll show you if we pass it again. They're easiest found near streams.
And they had passed many streams. Though still surrounded by tall grasses, the ground was softer here, the soil wetter.